This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. It's been a very strange spring, to say the very least. So many of us are stuck inside as tulips emerge from the dirt and birdsong erupts from outside, all those signs of life returning after the winter. So we'll start the show today with one of the great thinkers about the relationship between people and nature, Bill McKibben, who's at home in the woods of Vermont.
I'm Bill McKibben, and I'm a writer, and, you know, I spend a lot of my life working on the big crisis of our time, the climate crisis. And so, of course, the last few months, the last few weeks, I've been watching with great sadness and great interest as we try to deal with this crisis that has befallen us right now, the coronavirus, and thinking about the ways in which it overlaps with the other bigger ongoing dramas on our planet. Okay, we're just wandering down the driveway to the little marsh at the end because the last few nights the wood frogs have suddenly appeared. Their raucous spring ritual. And here's just this little swampy marsh. Now, the wood frogs will be quiet for a little while because they can hear us coming and they get a little nervous. But I bet if we stand over there quietly for a minute, the sound of the wood frogs will start to pick up again. Let's see. There's no possible way to get past the sadness of this moment. It, you know, haunts everybody all the time. But it is good sometimes to be able to remind yourself that the world, the planet, at least for now, goes on about its appointed mission. I mean, the wood frogs are very intent on mating with each other. They have not thrown in the towel. And also to be out at night and be reminded that we're a small part of something very, very, very large. That doesn't make it any better that people are dying or sad or unemployed or so on, but it does maybe help me anyway get through to the next day a little bit.
Bill McKibben in Vermont. Bill's joining us this week as we're marking an important anniversary. 50 years ago, April 22nd, 1970, people across the country gathered to demand government action on pollution. This was the first Earth Day, and something like 20 million Americans, a tenth of the population at the time, turned out for it.
Good evening. A unique day in American history is ending, a day set aside for a nationwide outpouring of mankind seeking its own survival. Earth Day.
It was as if Washington knew it was a special event and turned on spring's brightest sun for the celebration of Earth Day and a march on the Interior Department.
You probably know the story. The momentum of that first Earth Day helped lead to landmark legislation, the Clean Air and the Clean Water Acts. Richard Nixon, of all people, created the Environmental Protection Agency that very same year. And now, 50 years later, the situation is entirely different. The Trump administration has weakened the Endangered Species Act, withdrawn from the Paris Climate Accord, and much more. Just a few weeks ago, it rolled back auto emissions standards, and there's a move now to ease controls on the amount of mercury that's released by power plants. But there's no protest march this Earth Day, because, of course, people can't gather. And so, as Bill McKibben said earlier, we now face two devastating global crises at once: the climate crisis that's been building for decades, and the coronavirus pandemic that's ripped through the world in a matter of months. I called up Bill along with staff writer Elizabeth Colbert, who's covered climate change and extinction for The New Yorker for more than 20 years. I asked Betsy about the administration's latest rollback of environmental regulations, and why now.
They're actually up against an interesting deadline. So if there's a reg put into place, or in this case, it would be a reg, you know, unput into place regulation, in the last 60 legislative days of an administration, that can be overturned by a simple majority in both houses. So they're really racing to do as much damage as they possibly can in a short amount of time as possible. And the latest outrage was the fuel efficiency standards that the Obama administration had put into place to try to raise fuel efficiency standards for cars. It was all eminently doable. But when your goal is to, you know, maximize oil consumption, which we've also seen during this administration, that, you know, what they're concerned about is how do we get aid to oil companies? You know, obviously, we're just not on the same wavelength. Let's put it that way.
Well, oil prices are at historic lows. Bill, are there specific ways that the oil industry is taking advantage of this crisis?
I'll tell you that the thing that really just about knocked me to the ground in the last week was watching what's happening out on the prairie with the Keystone Pipeline. You'll recall this story. A bunch of us fought for years to keep it from getting built. Obama said it couldn't be built. Trump overturned that as soon as he got into office. But the oil companies have never been able to build it because there have been too many people in the way. There are 30,000 people who have trained to do nonviolent civil disobedience to stop them if they tried. Well, this is their moment. And so the government of Alberta gave the pipeline company several billion dollars. Chase Bank followed with $1 billion from some other banks. The company said they were going to work, and in fact, they're flying in people from around the country, construction workers, into rural areas that already have badly stressed healthcare systems, and on the edge of Indian reservations filled with people who lost 90% of their ancestors to pandemic over the last 500 years. This is an out-of-control machine, and it's doing damage right now. And of course, the bigger, larger damage it's doing is fueling the climate crisis that's going to just keep popping for decades to come, millennia to come.
You know, it's hard to say this, but the kind of shutdown, the frozenness of the globe at the moment has had some unintended consequences environmentally. You see these images taken from above about the way pollution has cleared up. You see photographs of the canals of Venice that are now absolutely clear, and you see fish which you never would have seen before. All kinds of images like this, stories like this. Do you think that'll have any effect on the politics of climate change going ahead, Betsy?
Well, I think that's a one of the many big questions of our moment. We are certainly seeing what we can do when we want to mobilize against a threat. You can say we've we've done it, you know, inadequately and too late. But we are doing a lot. And I think the question of are people, you know, really reexamining their core values, what do we need and what don't we need? And seeing that we can live a lot differently. Now, the alternative argument can also be made that there'll be this huge rush to try to reinvigorate the economy in potentially the worst possible ways. So I honestly don't know, you know, the famous, I guess, Churchill, never let a crisis go to waste. I certainly hope that we will not let this crisis go to waste, but I don't know that we won't let it go to waste.
Bill, same question.
Well, look, there's a bunch of things that I think are sinking in. One, and this is really important, science is real and physical reality matters. You know, Betsy and I have spent decades trying to convince people that physics and chemistry are real and you can't spin them and make them compromise and negotiate. If that's true for the CO2 molecule, it's doubly true for the COVID microbe, and it doesn't matter how much the guy in Washington stands at his little lectern and waves his arms. It's not a hoax, and it's not going to go to zero in a few days, and it's not going to be over by Easter, and it's not, you know, on and on and on. The second lesson that I think people are learning, or maybe, since we're now all epidemiologists, is time really matters. Like, we understand now that when the U.S. and South Korea got the first death, the South Koreans went to work. You know, they disrupted life a little, told people to stop gathering in big groups, started testing people. And, you know, 6 or 8 weeks later, they're kind of looking at this through the rearview mirror. We did the opposite, and exactly as we did with climate change. We ignored the warnings for the 30 years. Now we're in over our heads. So maybe people will get the message that we have to go quickly if we're going to deal with these kind of threats.
Betsy, we're in the midst of a radical reshaping of the economy, or potentially we are. Are there any lessons that can be drawn from how this transition is being managed that can be applied to climate change and to how to avert the worst kind of catastrophe?
Well, I mean, a lot of parallels are being drawn to the Depression. The idea that we need, you know, a huge investment program in our country, whether you call it the Green New Deal, whether you call it an infrastructure bill that has clean energy at its center and clean transportation. I want to say we need huge changes to our transportation system. If we took that lesson and didn't just pour money into dying and or should be dying sectors of our economy, we would be in a much, much better place 10, 20, 30 years from now.
Bill, will the pandemic change the way that climate is talked about in the presidential election?
We'll see if anything else other than the pandemic is talked about in the presidential election. But I do think that it reinforces what was already a growing political sense that you have to take the physical world seriously.
For all of us, this period of staying at home requires some kind of personal deprivation, and we have to go without things that we've taken for granted. Here in the city, even just walking around is something that you think twice about. Is there some lesson for us in how we tackle climate change in terms of how we need to change our personal behavior to accept limitations?
I mean, there are huge, where are our major carbon emissions coming from? They're coming from the power sector and they're coming from the transportation sector. And one of the fastest growing parts of the transportation sector and one of the hardest to deal with in terms of getting us off fossil fuels has been air travel. And now we have no air travel. And so I think that is a really interesting question, whether our constant, you know, sort of flying around the world, which I am as guilty as anyone of, whether we just go back to business as usual or whether we do rethink some of those ways in which we've been living that cannot be sustained. I mean, they honestly simply just cannot be sustained. I do think for everyone, like it or not, you know, it has been this moment of reset and realizing, well, we don't need that. Now, once again, that is for me sitting here. I don't work for the airline industry. If you do, you obviously say, well, we need that. That's my job. So these are huge questions that will play out over the coming years.
Bill?
Well, look, first thing to be said is, and it draws on what Betsy just said, like the climate crisis, the corona pandemic has made it clear just what a horrible idea it is to have a deeply unequal society. And so I hope that one of the things that we take from this, and I trust we will, is that we can no longer continue to have a world where five or six people have as much wealth as hundreds of millions of other people. It doesn't work because those people, the poor people, get sick and die. And it doesn't work because you can't have the kind of social trust you need to run a society. And that goes to the place that may be most important here. I mean, what's the thing I think that most people miss above all is just the chance to be gregarious, to be with other people. Human beings are socially evolved primates. It wasn't that many generations ago that we were, you know, sitting on the floor of the savanna picking lice out of each other's fur, you know? And so it's hard to be told not to go touch people, hug people, be near people, talk to people, shake hands, all the things that we're used to. When we get out of detention, I hope that it will be a reminder to us about how much social distancing we've been doing already these last few decades, how much we've kind of retreated into a world of screens. And I think that we might, just might, prize each other a little bit more, and that if we do, we can begin to see how in that pleasure we might begin to replace some of the consumption that Betsy's been talking about and that drives every environmental challenge that we face. So who knows? I mean, it's also possible we'll just set up all the pins in the bowling alley again. You know, that's the other possibility. But let's hope not. I think we're better than that.
Bill McKibben and Elizabeth Colbert, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Bill McKibben and Elizabeth Colbert. You can find both of their writings on the environment at newyorker.com, and in the same place, you can subscribe to our newsletter called The Climate Crisis, which Bill writes. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We've been talking this hour about the coronavirus pandemic and the environment. how our current situation changes the calculus globally, but also personally.
This whole experience has been just bonkers on so many levels, but like when the weather is nice, it changes the whole situation.
I grew up around nature and I pretty much took it for granted. Now when I walk, I'm really seeing the height of trees. I'm looking at their branches. I'm noticing the colors, the shape, the different textures.
I've paid more attention to the stars while I'm out walking. That's definitely a thing. I saw a shooting star the other day. That was super cool. I'm appreciative of the small amounts of nature that I get to see these days.
Keep in mind, like, I live in a very densely populated area, and even still, it's like, I, like, need to be outside and go places and walk, and, like, especially on the weekends, like, go out and see something other than the room that I sit in 7 days a week.
All colors of green, from lime green to olive green to hunter green.
Yeah, I think I appreciate outside more and nature more because, you know, when you just do the same thing every day, you know, you get up, you get ready, you go to work, you come home, you do your daily routine, you don't think about those things. But now that we're indoors most of the time, it's like you just feel like the need to go.
It feels more deliberately hygienic. It's like, okay, now we are going to take a walk. You know, I think before this, my husband and I each had our own various ways of exercising, but now we make a point of making the walks together.
We have a park, huge park, but I'm scared to go there. And no matter how I have a mask or something, it's not the same thing.
It's an uncanny feeling. So it looks the same as it did before, but it's not the same.
It's not the same. The natural world has taken on a new edge where something we can't even see appears to be attacking us. When we talk about confronting the COVID-19 virus, it's with metaphors of war and battle. The president said we are fighting an invisible enemy, an evil beast. And yet we have to understand that the virus is doing what all living things do naturally, reproducing as much as it can. We don't know exactly how this novel coronavirus first infected humans, but scientists have done a lot of work to understand where these viruses came from in the first place. Staff writer Carolyn Corman talked recently with someone who searches out coronaviruses in their natural habitat.
So first, could you just tell us who you are, your name, and your job, and what you do, and how you hunt viruses?
Sure. My name is John Epstein. I'm a disease ecologist with EcoHealth Alliance in New York, which is a nonprofit science-based organization that studies epidemics and tries to figure out how they happen and how to stop them. So the job that I do, the research that I do, is specifically on zoonotic viruses. Those are viruses that are carried by animals and jump into people or spread into people. Viruses like Ebola, SARS coronavirus, the current SARS coronavirus 2 that's causing COVID-19. And one thing that these viruses have in common is that they're carried by different types of bats. And so I've spent a lot of my career working with different bat species and trying to understand the viruses that they carry.
So, as I understand it, back in 2004, you got on a plane to China to track down the first SARS virus, which is a relative of the current coronavirus. Where would you go? I mean, how did you decide which bat caves to visit and which markets to visit? And what was the experience like? How did you do the work?
Well, the markets where SARS emerged were in the major cities. And so we wanted to start near there, figuring that the animals probably most likely came from the surrounding area, and then we'd work our way outwards. And about 2 or 3 hours drive out of the city, you get to farmland. But there are these enormous and beautiful limestone mountains or hills, and limestone formations are great for having caves. Some of them were, long and tortuous, maybe 10 feet high at the ceiling tunnels that were going into big caverns. And sometimes these caverns would open up and they were the size of airplane hangars.
Wow.
And so we were in these enormous caverns. And the way that we catch bats is that we set up nets. And the nets are typically like a volleyball net that's strung between two masts or two poles. They could be bamboo poles. We were hand carrying these in. And then we also had hand nets that look like big butterfly nets. And sometimes you can get close enough to bats that they're hanging on the ceiling that you can simply catch them with a butterfly type net. So the trick was to position our net in a flyway that would be heavily trafficked, congested, where lots of bats were flying through and that just simply couldn't avoid the net, even if they saw it.
And about how many bats, though, are there in the cave? I mean, are hundreds of thousands? Or?
Yeah, there could be thousands, tens of thousands. It really varied on the size of the cave and the species. We would go in during the day. Bats would tend to be sleeping on the ceiling. But of course, once you're in there and disturb them, they fly around.
Mm.
What we did was we would go into the caves and we would set up a sampling station.
Mm. And so you take, in effect, nasal swabs? When you're taking samples?
No, not we take a oropharyngeal or oral swab. So we use tiny little pediatric-sized, you know, cotton swabs that can fit into the bat's mouth and ideally into the back of its throat. And that's where we, you know, rub it a little bit, let the bat chew on it and try to collect saliva that way.
Huh.
And then bats will often, you know, help us out by providing a little fecal pellet when we catch them or put them into bags when we catch them. And so then we get a fecal sample. And, you know, on rare occasion, depending on the bat and the size of the bat, we might even get a urine sample. And then we collect blood from veins on the arm of the bat. We're able to collect tiny amounts of blood, and then we release the animal right on site.
And what would you think about when you held the bats in your hand?
Well, I mean, I love working with bats. I love working with animals in general. I've worked with the largest bats in the world, which is the Malayan flying fox in Malaysia, which is a giant fruit bat that has about a 5-foot wingspan, weighs about 2 pounds. It's like a flying chihuahua or a flying squirrel. But they're adorable animals. You know, they have a sort of fox-like head, and these are very social animals, very charismatic animals. Their temperament can vary. Some of them can be very feisty and bitey. Others can be very docile. Smaller insect-eating bats, they range from the really tiny to about the size of your thumb to a little bit bigger, maybe the size of the palm of your hand.
And what did you discover from hunting down the first SARS virus? What does it tell us about, you know, this its cousin or this new coronavirus?
It was really interesting. At the time, we didn't know which species we were going to find anything in or if we'd find anything at all. And after testing a lot of different bats, it turned out that horseshoe bats, which is an insect-eating group of bats, we were carrying a virus that was closely related to SARS. And in fact, it looked to be ancestral. So what that told us was that we had kind of found a progenitor virus, one from which SARS likely came. And that was the first clue that bats were probably a natural reservoir for these viruses.
How does the virus get from a bat into another animal? You know, how does the virus kind of jump this species barrier?
Well, different viruses have different abilities to infect one or more hosts. What happens is some viruses use a certain strategy for getting inside of cells, and they need to get inside of cells in the body to hijack the cell's machinery and make more virus. And they have there's what's called a receptor on the cell surface that a virus uses, like a lock and key, where the virus might have the key and it needs a specific lock that certain cells might have. SARS and SARS coronavirus 2, which causes COVID-19, use a receptor called the ACE2 receptor, which is found in a lot of mammals. It's conserved across mammals, including people. And we have ACE2 receptors in the cells in our lower lungs, which is why we get a lower respiratory disease when infected with SARS-CoV-2. And we also have some ACE2 receptors in our intestinal cells. So we know that SARS and SARS-CoV-2 can cause GI infections as well. And so that's why sometimes diarrhea is associated with this coronavirus. And so a virus's ability to jump host from its natural reservoir to other species is really a product of, does it have the right key to fit into locks that are carried by different hosts? And is there opportunity for it to get out of its natural reservoir and into a different host? And that's really an important point right there for this whole conversation, is how do these viruses emerge? It's because of activities that people do. It's human activities that change the environment around us and bring us and our livestock into closer contact with wildlife. What's happening now, more than ever in history, is that the human population is at an all-time high and growing. We're putting incredible pressure on natural systems. We're deforesting, we're clearing land for agriculture, we're moving our livestock and ourselves closer to what were formerly pristine habitats. And so there's more opportunity to make contact with species that we haven't traditionally had contact with. We're starting to learn that bats seem to be particularly adept at tolerating viral infection, and that would explain why that they're able to carry so many different types of viruses.
And does it have to do with the fact that they're the only mammal that flies?
That's been a hypothesis that's developing, and it turns out that bats handle viral infection differently than other mammals. When we get infected with a virus, part of our body's response is inflammation. That's part of our fever response. It's part of our body's way of sending white blood cells to attack that virus. And the result is we have inflammation internally. And sometimes that's part of the disease process. Our own body's response can cause tissue damage, in extreme cases, organ failure. So that can be, you know, a really important process. Bats, along the way, somehow have lost some of the genes that are responsible for inflammation. So when a bat gets infected with a virus, it virtually doesn't develop any noticeable disease. Mm. Now, that's not always true, but it's generally true that bats tend to get very mild or no disease when they're carrying viruses like Nipah virus or relatives of Ebola virus. Now, the hypothesis is that this coincides with the evolution of flight. Bats are the only mammals that have powered flight. And the process of flying, of flapping those wings, sometimes hundreds of times a minute, is incredibly stressful at the cellular level in the body. It can cause oxidative damage, which damages cells and the DNA inside cells. And to cope with that, bats have evolved to have mechanisms that dampen the immune response to that stress, to that physiologic exertion. And that might be why they don't also have inflammation when they're infected with viruses.
Wow. In some ways, it's just remarkable to think about the virus having evolved to the point where it's so dangerous to people. It's remarkable, right? I mean, that the virus would have everything it needed to be able to transmit so effectively between people and cause such severe disease.
It's a lot like, imagine the lottery balls. This is big, you know, the balls with numbers on them, and you turn the wheel and one ball comes out. Think of viruses that way. There's an enormous spectrum of viruses, all slight variations on a theme. And most of those may never have the ability to jump out of their natural host and infect other species. And it's the ones that do, the few that do, that we notice because they cause trouble.
Do you see bats as dangerous in any way or more,
no,
you know, more as a beautiful animal?
No, the most dangerous thing about these bats is us tripping and falling in the cave when we're walking in there. Bats are, you know, they're a maligned animal. Unfortunately, they have a really bad reputation, but they're the most important animals in the world to people for so many reasons. Insect-eating bats provide incredible amounts of pest control. They eat moths and beetles that can damage crops by the ton. They eat mosquitoes. And then fruit-eating bats play an important role as pollinators and seed dispersers. In fact, half of the rainforest in the old world, in Africa and Asia, exists because of bats pollinating and dropping seeds. So without bats, we'd be in a lot of trouble. So no, I think they're terrific animals.
Well, John, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
That was Jonathan Epstein, a disease ecologist, and he spoke with Carolyn Cormon. You can find her article From Bats to Human Lungs at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. This week is the 50th anniversary of the first Earth Day in April 1970. So to close the show, we're going to remember Rachel Carson. Probably more than any other person, Carson helped to launch the environmental movement as we know it today. And it came with her book, Silent Spring. But Carson's earlier writings, also published in The New Yorker, contain the seeds of what made her so influential. Here's Carson speaking in 1951.
I seem to have been born with a fascination for the sea. For years before I ever saw it, I thought about it, dreamed about it, and wondered what it would be like.
Carson's writings about the sea were filled with a sense of wonder and poetry. Here's actress Charlene Woodard reading Rachel Carson.
In midsummer, life in the surface water slacks to a slower pace. The red jellyfish, Cyania, usually has grown from the size of a thimble to that of an umbrella. This great jellyfish moves through the sea with rhythmic pulsations, trailing long tentacles, and as likely as not, shepherding a little group of young cod or haddock, which find shelter under its bell and travel with it.
And here's Jill Lepore, a staff writer for The New Yorker and a professor of history at Harvard.
So Rachel Carson was born nowhere near the sea. She was born near the Allegheny River in western Pennsylvania in 1907. She grew up on a kind of dilapidated farm. It wasn't really a working farm anymore. Her father was sort of a bit of a traveling salesman, but not a successful one. She went to college to become a poet. She was going to study English. She, though, changed her whole focus of her college education when she took a biology class. And she fell in love with her biology professor, became deeply passionately attached to this quite incredible woman, Mary Scott Skinker, and who spotted in young Rachel Carson something quite promising and special and managed to secure for her a summer position at Woods Hole on Cape Cod, this path-breaking oceanographic institute. This was 1928. She was 21 years old. She'd never seen or smelled the ocean before.
I had my first prolonged contact with the sea at the Marine Biological Laboratory at Woods Hole. There, I never tired of watching the tidal currents racing through the hole, that wonderful place of whirlpools and eddies and swiftly running water. And I loved to watch the waves breaking at Nobsca Point after a storm.
She didn't really know how to swim. She was terrified of boats. But there was something just so magical. Sort of, if you picture a little boy always wanted to be an astronaut, kind of landing on Mars.
The summer sea may glitter with millions of moving pinpricks of light, like an immense swarm of fireflies. This effect is produced by a shoal of the brilliantly phosphorescent shrimp, Meganictithines, a creature of cold and darkness, and of the places where icy water rolls upwards from the depths and bubbles to the surface.
From that first summer at Woods Hole, Carson would roll up her pant legs and take off her shoes, and she would climb all over the shoreline. She would climb up and down the dunes. She would wade out into the water. She would be gone for hours upon hours upon hours. She would get up in the middle of the night to wander out to the beach with a flashlight looking for the nightlife.
I remember a moss-carpeted ledge jutting out from the rock wall over sea depths where laminarias rolled in with the tide. The moss was saturated, holding water as faithfully as a sponge. Down within the deep pile of that moss, I caught a glimpse of bright rosy color.
Carson became devoted to the study of the sea after that summer in Woods Hole, and she decided to go to a graduate school. She entered a PhD program at Johns Hopkins, a really ambitious thing for any woman to do. She started in 1932. We're in the depths of the Depression by now. Her family has no money. Her family is entirely dependent on her, and she's in graduate school. She moves to Baltimore, but her mother, her ailing father, her divorced sister, her sister's two really little children all come to live with her, and Carson has to support them. She works as a lab assistant. She teaches biology. She ends up leaving her PhD program with a master's degree and takes a job at the Bureau of Fisheries, where, unsurprisingly, she's hired to write brochures. The kinds of brochures they were putting together were, you know, about as interesting as the terms of service when you click on to a new app. Like, they're just really technical writing. They might explain the life cycle of a seagull, for instance. So she's writing brochures, and they have this just majesty. They're just this majestic, and they're intimate, and they're also shocking, and they're dramatic, and they have characters, but no one has heard anyone write about the sea like this before. Certainly not the Bureau of Fisheries. And so her supervisor says, look, your writing is actually too good for these brochures. You should start sending it around. And her first breakthrough essay in 1937 is published in The Atlantic, which I always think is somehow fitting. And it knocked people's socks off.
People often seem to be surprised that a woman should have written a book about the sea. This is particularly true, I find, of men. Perhaps they have been accustomed for a long time to thinking about the more exciting fields of science as exclusively masculine domains. In fact, one of my correspondents a few days ago addressed me as Dear Sir, explaining that although he knew perfectly well that I was a woman, he simply could not bring himself to acknowledge the fact.
Tide pools contain within their depths mysterious worlds where all the beauty of the sea is subtly portrayed in miniature. I remember one so small that as I lay outstretched on the rocks beside it, I could easily touch its far shore. Its floor was paved with mussels. Their shells were a soft color, the misty blue of distant mountain ranges, and their presence gave an illusion of depth. The water in which they lived was so clear as to be invisible to my eyes. I could detect the interface between air and water only by the sense of coldness on my fingertips. This crystal water was filled with sunshine, an infusion and distillation of light that reached down and surrounded each of the small and resplendent shellfish with its glowing radiance.
Carson complained a lot about the way people wrote about the sea and the way they wrote about nature, which was they made a catalog of things. And there'd be no relationship between one thing and the other, between the environment and the creature.
The shells of the mussels provided a place of attachment for the only other life that I could see in the pool. Fine as the finest threads, the basal stems of colonies of hydroids traced their faintly discernible lines across the shells. The hydroids belonged to the group called Sertularia, in which each individual of a colony and all the supporting and connecting branches are enclosed in transparent sheaths, like a tree in winter after an ice storm.
She saw, when she looked down into a tide pool, how everything was attached to everything else, how everything was dependent on everything else.
I lay beside the pool and with my hand lens brought the hydroids into clearer view. They seemed to me to look nothing so much as pieces of exquisite cut glass, each of them, perhaps, a segment of an intricately wrought chandelier. On what, I wondered, were all these Sertularians, carnivorous like all hydroids, feeding. From their very abundance, I knew that whatever creatures served them as food must be many times more abundant than the hydroids themselves. Yet I could see nothing. Then, somewhere in the crystal clarity of the pool, my eye detected...
So you can picture Carson there lying on her stomach with her face pressed into that tide pool. That's how she gains and captures your attention, bringing you intimately into that world and giving you this tour of it from what appears to be the most vulnerable, tiniest, most insignificant piece of this tiny, tiny little tide pool and showing you step by step how you too are tied to them.
Yet I knew that it was only the imperfection of human vision that prevented me from seeing the microscopic hordes of water fleas, copepods, and worms on which the hydroids were preying with those groping, searching tentacles that were themselves barely discernible. Even more than the visible life in the pool, the life I could not see came to dominate my thoughts. And finally, the members of that invisible throng seemed to me the most powerful beings in the pool. Both the hydroids and the mussels were utterly dependent on this invisible flotsam of the tide streams. The mussels as passive strainers of plant plankton, the hydroids as active predators seizing and ensnaring microscopic animals. And should the plankton become less plentiful? Should the incoming tide stream somehow become drained of this life? Then the pool would become a pool of death, both for the mussels in their shells blue as mountains, and for the crystal coolness of the hydroids.
So what Carson does so effectively here is communicate just how important are things that we can't see. She's teaching a reader who might wonder about whether invisible things matter, that they do matter. And that's really the same insight that she communicates that she brings to her most famous work, Silent Spring, which appears in 1962, but which Carson had been thinking about since 1945.
The chemicals to which life is asked to make its adjustment are no longer merely the calcium and silica and copper and the rest of the minerals washed out of the rocks and carried in rivers to the sea. They are also the synthetic creations of man's inventive mind. Brewed in his laboratories and having no counterparts in nature. To adjust to these chemicals would require time on the scale that is nature's. It would require not merely the years of a man's life, but the life of generations.
Carson would say about the chemical companies that they thought that they could repeal the balance of nature, that you couldn't repeal the balance of nature any more than you could rescind the law of gravity, that this audacity of chemists and scientists in trying to conquer nature with these pesticides was wrongheaded. And she made that claim with great temerity and determination at a time when she herself was suffering from cancer. She had been diagnosed with breast cancer. She'd had a radical mastectomy. She'd had radiation. She was quite ill. She was considerably hobbled. She'd lost her hair. She was often in a wheelchair. And yet she hid her illness from the whole world, went before Congress to testify, did her best to get her claims out into the world, and began planning her next project. She wanted to go back after Silent Spring to writing about the sea.
Curious changes have been taking place, with many animals invading the cold temperate zone from warmer waters and pushing up through Maine and even into Canada.
She'd noticed, as many scientists had begun to notice by the 1950s, that the world's oceans were getting warmer.
This phenomenon is clearly related to the widespread change of climate that is now well recognized. A general warming up having been noticed first in the Arctic regions, then in the subarctic, and more recently in the temperate areas of the northern states.
We tend to think the debate about climate change is a recent debate, or that the observation that the seas are rising is a new thing. But this is something Carson noticed in the 1950s.
One of the most impressive examples of this northward movement is provided by the green crab, once unknown north of the Cape, but now well known to every clam fisherman in Maine because of its habit of preying on the young states of the clam. At the beginning of this century, zoological manuals gave its range from New Jersey to Cape Cod. In 1905, it was reported near Portland. And by 1930, specimens had been collected in Hancock County, about midway along the Maine coast.
I picture Rachel Carson sitting in her house on an island in Maine, looking down at the shore, puzzling over the rising of the seas. Decades and decades ago, and it's painful. It's painful to picture that and think about what might have been if she hadn't died. Just embarking on this study, this inquiry, wondering what was causing the oceans to get warmer and these species to migrate. At a time when she had a tremendous purchase on American politics, on international politics, she had a kind of authority that scientists don't have anymore. What would that book have done in the world?
Looking down into the small world that is limited by the walls of the cave, I feel the rhythms of the greater sea world. It is the green sponges lining the pool that, for me, give this cave a special quality, a sense of the continuing flow of time. As I watch, a fish swims in, a shadow in the green lights. Compared to the ancient sponges, the fish is almost a symbol of modernity, its ancestry traceable only half as far back into the past. And I, whose eyes behold the images of the two as though they were my contemporaries, am a mere newcomer, whose ancestors inhabited the earth so briefly that my present seems somehow anachronistic. And as I lie looking into the cave and thinking these thoughts, the surge of waters rises and floods across the rock behind me. The tide is rising.
That's Charlene Woodard reading from the work of Rachel Carson. And we heard staff writer Jill Lepore. Her history of the United States is called These Truths. I'm David Remnick, and I hope if you can, that you can get some time outside this week with appropriate social distancing, of course. Be well, and please join us next time for the New Yorker Radio Hour.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann.
With additional help from Isaac Jones and Josh Swartz.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.